It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And for the rest of the hour today, we are going to continue taking a look at the Trump administration's tariff policies, what they mean for trade and our state and our national economy. 10% tariffs on imported goods took effect over the weekend, and tomorrow, Wednesday, even higher taxes will go into place for many countries. 25% on many Canadian and Mexican goods, 25% on South Korea, a rate of at least 54% on China, which President Trump has threatened to make even higher. The effect of all this on the stock market has been dramatic. The S&P 500 was on pace for its largest percentage decline since the Black Monday crash in October 1987. But as they say, stocks go up, stocks go down. There was a significant jump in the positive direction, at least as we were going to air Tuesday morning. For his part, President Trump says the tariffs will boost the economy, making America wealthy again and moving manufacturing back to the United States. But the message among Republicans is that our economic pain will get worse before it gets better. Trump said that himself back in February.
We may have short term some little pain, and people understand that. But long term, the United States has been ripped off by virtually every country in the world. We have deficits with almost every country, not every country, but almost. And we're going to change it.
To talk more about what these tariffs mean, how they might reshape our economy, and how our neighbor to the north is reacting to this, Hadrian Mertens-Kirkwood is senior researcher at Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. Hadrian, welcome to the 21st Show.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
Also, Cecile Shea, she's at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, where she's a non-resident senior fellow on global security and diplomacy. She previously had 2 decades experience as a U.S. diplomat with postings in Japan, Thailand, Pakistan, Scotland, and Israel. Cecile, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thanks. It's really great to be here again.
And Dr. Barbara Ribbons is with us again, director of the Carson and Iris Varner International Business Institute at Illinois State University. Barbara, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Listeners, again, you can join us for the rest of the hour at 800-222-9455. How do you expect these tariffs to affect you? Or maybe you don't think they will. And will these tariffs help or hurt the economy? Let us know what you think. 800-222-9455. All right, Cecile, I'm going to begin with you. We were talking just last month on the show about tariffs after the Canadian and Mexican tariffs had kicked in, but weeks before Trump's so-called Liberation Day. I wonder, what was your initial reaction after the announcement last Wednesday?
Well, particularly as someone who spent a lot of her adult life in Asia, I was shocked, first of all, that the tariffs for a lot of the Asian countries, excluding China, of course, we knew the tariffs on China would be high. But I don't think anyone was expecting those kind of tariffs on countries like Japan and Cambodia, Thailand, and as well as a lot of very, very poor countries in Africa. No one was expecting those tariffs to be that high. The second thing that mystified me was how they had come up with the numbers, because President Trump claimed that the tariffs were going to be reciprocal. So if a country charges us a lot of tariffs, we would charge them a lot of tariffs. Well, you know, Japan charges us, I think, 2.7% tariffs, only 2.7%, way down from what they used to be, by the way. And yet we are now looking at charging them over 30%. So it turns out that what, and you kind of hear this in some of his comments recently, he wasn't actually talking about reciprocity in tariffs. He was talking about reciprocity in the trade balance. So we sell more stuff to some countries and less stuff to other countries. We happen to sell a lot of services to countries, less manufactured goods. We sell a lot of food to countries, but other countries sell us more stuff, but less services. So he wants us to even out the trade in goods. And honestly, that's just not going to happen. There is no way in the modern economy that a country as rich as ours is going to sell as much stuff to Cambodia as we buy from Cambodia. That just can't happen. So I'm really a little frustrated, both with the language, but also, as you point out, surprised with the route that this kind of went. And I guess I'm not the only one, because apparently there are a lot of people who work on Wall Street who were also surprised.
I heard George Will recently talking about this idea of trade deficits, and he said he has an incurable lifelong trade deficit with a woman who's been cutting his hair. He constantly pays her for that, and she has never once paid him for anything. just as a way to think about that. Barbara, let me bring you into the conversation. How are you thinking about this, especially in terms of how President Trump's team went about calculating these tariffs?
Yeah, I'm teaching an international business class this semester. And when we met on Thursday, one of the things I did was pull up definitions and get the students to tell me the definitions and to tell me what was wrong with Trump's definitions. And that was pretty sobering for them to realize, because they, you know, most people, oh, if it's on the screen, it's real. And it's not. And so that was a very sobering part of it. And I think is adding to a lot of the uncertainty, as Camille alluded, he's switching up and mixing terminology and mixing numbers in ways that are nonsensical. And that's creating a lot more uncertainty, even for people who might think tariffs are not a bad thing. They're blown away by, wait, what's going on? What's the real story here?
Hadrian Mertens-Kirkwood at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. I wonder what your view is from north of the United States. You know, Canada's Illinois' top trading partner. How do you see this affecting our relationship?
It's been a really challenging period here. I mean, it's been a challenging period south of the border too, but Canada is very, very dependent on American trade. We are the biggest trading partner for the U.S., but as a proportion of our economy, trade with the U.S. is just so important for Canada. And there's a real risk that if these tariffs hold, and who knows, I mean, your previous guest was talking about all the uncertainty around how tariffs on autos will be applied, for example. We don't really know what a 25% tariff is going to look like in practice. It's very complicated, but we're already seeing layoffs in Canada. We could be going into recession very quickly. If the U.S. ends up going into recession as a result of these global tariffs, I mean, that's going to have knock-on effects everywhere in the world, but especially for Canada. So we're very much along for the ride here. It's distressing. There's all kinds of political debate happening about what Canada should do, what we possibly can do when we're so dependent on the U.S. But it is absolutely top of mind up here.
Barbara, what sort of effect have these tariffs had on Illinois already in terms of how, you know, entrepreneurs and businesses are thinking about their future here?
Well, I think the big thing we have to recognize is there's the short-term effect and there's the long-term effect. And in the short term, I think the uncertainty that Mr. Goolsbee talked about, people are just holding their breath. You know, whether it's starting a new business or starting to build a new factory, a lot of those plans are going to be put on hold because they want to see what's really going to happen here. Long term, I think we have to recognize that Illinois, but everywhere, but Illinois especially, I think, has to think about how much time it would take to move production back here or shift to do the kinds of things he's saying he wants us to do. To take the idea of, okay, we're going to move production of X back to Illinois. We've got to build a factory or find a factory. We have to find and train workers. We have to set up production. We have to do prototypes. That takes 5 years. I'm not sure anybody's willing to start doing that sort of investment, given Trump's term is 4 years and what happens after that. So this uncertainty is just causing a lot of hesitation, and that hesitation is going to cause recession, delayed purchasing, delayed investment. And I think we also have to think about the foreign direct investment into Illinois. We have a lot of international companies that have facilities in Illinois, and they're going to be holding back from investing in Illinois as well. And that's a very powerful component of things.
Cecile, we asked members of our texting group about how they feel about this. I want to share one message in particular, although there were a number of people who said this idea that they might be cutting back as this goes on. Ryan in Champaign, for example, texted to say, I will stop buying all non-essentials. I'm already living paycheck to paycheck. This will hurt the bottom 90% of the country. Trump is purposefully tanking the economy to do another mass wealth transfer to billionaires and another transfer of public resources to private companies. He enjoys hurting people. He cares about his own money. Thank you for that message, Ryan. Cecile, from the economic side, what effect can everyday people like us expect to see in our lives from these tariffs?
Yeah, so there's really two issues. There's the psychological and then there's the actual. So let's start with the psychological, which is, I think, what the first text refers to, and which I understand because I am staring retirement in the face. And so when you have a week like we've had with the stock market, you know, dropping that amount, it scares people. And so they stop buying things. They stop spending money. Maybe they cancel their trip that they were going to take this summer. Maybe they decide to tighten the belt a little bit because, you know, they don't want to spend down their retirement anymore. Or they want to sock away a little bit more money. They hear the R word, recession, in the news at night, and they maybe worry about their jobs. And so again, they cut back. And so what happens is that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because there's less consumption. There's less people going to restaurants. There's less people, you know, buying the latest gadget or maybe spending money on gifts. And so that starts to cause the economy to slow down. Then when you add on that, the fact that, you know, it looks like at least some of these tariffs are pretty much definitely are pretty much going to go into place. The president doesn't sound like he's willing to stop all of them. And that's going to cause prices to go up. And if it's a price for a item that you don't really need and you would have bought 6 months ago, but you're not going to buy it now, well, then that's, again, a hit on the economy. And if you're a small maker of a small doodad, there was a great essay today in the New York Times by a man who makes this kind of splatter guard. So when you're frying food in your kitchen doesn't get so dirty and gross while you're frying the food. And he made two points. One is people are willing to buy his splatter guard at $24. I bought one today. I was curious after I read the article. They're willing to spend $24, but they're not going to be willing to spend $39. And so at this point, he doesn't know. Does he order more from China because they're made in China? Does he go ahead and bring them into the country, or does he not? Because he won't be able to sell them if they end up costing $39 after all the various expenses caused by tariffs. And if he doesn't sell them, then that's going to be less money for Amazon, less money for advertisers, less money for the creatives to do his advertising, less jobs for the delivery truck drivers, less jobs for the longshoremen at the ports who bring these goods through the ports. So the knock-on effects are going to be real. They won't be felt tomorrow, but they could be felt pretty quickly. At least there will be early signs of the kind of hits that will be taken by companies and that will then be passed down the supply chain.
Hadrian, what sort of timeline are you hearing from people in Canada in terms of, you know, well, let's wait and see and hope this blows over, or, oh my gosh, this is our new reality. We need to figure out how we're going to live with this.
It's a great question, and there's no clear answer. You've got some industries, you've got some politicians, some regions of the country saying, let's just wait this out. Everything's going to go back to normal. Let's not make a fuss about it. And then you've got another part of the country that's saying, you know, we got to fight back. This is a trade war. Let's use every tool we have, export taxes, you know, capital controls on U.S. investment, et cetera, et cetera. And there is no consensus. This is just a very live debate. But the real clear theme, and this is a word we've heard a lot already this hour, is uncertainty. If we thought this was, or if we believe this to be a permanent move, not just by Trump, but by the U.S. in general, like this is the new, you know, U.S. approach to international trade, we're always going to have a minimum tariff of 10% or whatever, that would require a certain response. If we think this is going to blow over in a week, because that sometimes happens with Trump, it requires a very different response. And we don't know any better than you do what's going to happen here. And that makes it just very difficult to mount any kind of coherent policy response.
Do you think, Hadrian, the era of globalization is over, or at least coming to the end of this chapter?
That's a big question.
Yeah,
I don't think it's over full stop. Trade is going to continue of necessity. No country in the modern global economy can operate fully on its own, either in terms of goods or services. So trade, international cooperation, it's still going to be there. But it may be a very different version of that globalization moving forward, where there is more domestic production, there is more autonomy that each country strives for, in contrast to the last sort of 30, 40 years of trying to highly specialize in every part of the world.
Let's get a couple of callers in at 800-222-9455. And we'll go first to Liam, calling from Springfield on line one. Liam, thank you for calling in.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Hey, as you probably know, that Trump was selling Bibles, and I have a Associated Press article in front of me, and his Bibles were printed in China. In fact, he spent $342,000, and each Bible was $3 each, and then he sold them for $59.99 with a total revenue of $7 million. So my question is this. His fundamental argument is that we should manufacture in the United States so we can create more jobs. Well, the question I have, why didn't he have his Bibles printed in the United States and create more jobs? Okay, thank you very much, guys. Have a nice day.
All right, thanks, Liam. That is an interesting question. One more call. We need to take a break, but I think we can get the call in and maybe talk about it when we come back. Paul is calling from Urbana on line two. Paul, thank you for calling in.
Yeah, I have all the misgivings that are going around about this sledgehammer approach to doing something about the trading system, which I think there are critiques to be made of it. But I am alerted by Lori Wallach of Rethinking Trade that one of the things that's likely to happen, we have evidence from the COVID problems that and the supply chain, a lot of that was not because of supply chains. It was a gouging opportunity. And I think we're going to be needing to sort out what's really going on. And I'm not confident that the FTC or the Commerce Department is actually going to look for any gouging because it wasn't even done very well during COVID.
Yeah, and whether they're even staffed enough to do it. Paul, thanks for that call. All right, we are going to continue after a break. We're talking with Barbara Ribbons of Illinois State University, Cecile Shea at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and Hadrian Mertens-Kirkwood at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives about our new tariffs system that we are living under. Is it temporary? Is it permanent? Those are some of the questions we all have. 800-222-9455 if you want to join us today. 800-222-9455. More to come here on The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about the many tariffs President Donald Trump has put into place and on our international trading partners and the effect they'll have on the economy here in Illinois, in the Midwest, and really around the world. We asked members of our texting group about what all these tariffs mean for the country and for you. Laura in Peoria Heights said, I think the stock market tanking is a pretty good indicator of what Trump's tariffs are doing to the economy. Tariffs will absolutely raise prices on everything, which will definitely have a negative impact on my finances. His performance is as expected. She says his goal is to ruin our government, democracy, and economy, and he's right on schedule. But we did hear from Tony in Champaign who said the stated goal is more than okay. We need everyone in a living wage job. But Trump is trying to achieve that while leaving the financial sector untouched. That will end up avoiding manufacturing with good pay. We're talking about this with Hadrian Mertens-Kirkwood, senior researcher at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, Cecile Shea at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and Barbara Ribbons, director of the Carson and Iris Varner International Business Institute at Illinois State University. 800-222-9455 is the number to join us today. 800-222-9455. Barbara, can you talk a little bit more about, you know, onshoring of production work, right? We heard that in that message, the stated goal, we want more people in living wage jobs. There's this, you know, nostalgia for the manufacturing economy here in America. What sort of timeline would we be looking at for that to actually come about? You know, especially with the idea of that if, you know, economic downturns typically lead to changes of power in Washington. So maybe all this goes away in 2 or 4 years.
Yeah, I think a minimum time to onshore, especially the hardcore manufacturing jobs, we're talking at the very least 3 to 5 years. And they're not, it's not going to happen on a dime. It's just not. I mean, we have the example here in Normal of Rivian, who came in and took over a car plant that was already set up as a car plant, right? And it still took them several years to get production up, people trained, And I think a piece of what's going on is Trump has never been involved in manufacturing. He has no idea, and apparently doesn't have people around him who do either, about how slow these responses are going to be to have effective production. I mean, we could throw something up that does something, but it's not going to be quality production in a really short time frame. And so that suggests that the hard times could last quite long. And I think we have to also remember there's been a shift in our education system and our goals for our young people. How many people come out of high school and want to work assembling cars? Not as many as 50 years ago. So we have changed to a more knowledge economy and set the aspirations for our young people to do that. I see my college grads, they don't even want to work in a warehouse for a couple months to learn how it works. They just want to be a manager right out of college. And so that there's going to be an issue.
Interesting. One of our former producers actually went to manage an Amazon warehouse. You mentioned that.
Yeah.
All right. Cecile, let me ask you, and we touched on this a little bit last time we talked about this, but can you just talk about how these tariffs, now that they're here, how they fit into the bigger picture of the United States' general changing role in the global order, I guess you might say?
Yeah, I mean, that's very, very disturbing. And I'm sure that Hadrian's going to have something to say about this also. But, you know, after the horror of World War II, the utter devastation and the loss of so many American lives and European lives and Asian lives, the U.S. and other countries that believed in freedom and wanted to avoid another horrible war like that decided that the way to do that was to build relationships among countries. Security relationships first, like NATO and like the U.S. treaties with other countries, and also especially trade relationships. The theory is, and it's a theory that has worked for 70 years, the theory is that the more that countries trade together, particularly if those countries have high expectations in behavior of each other, so demand good human rights and demand, you know, worker rights and things, that that will make wars between those countries less likely. And it has worked. And the U.S. has been a leader in that. And not just that, we have twisted arms to get countries to lower trade barriers. I mentioned Japan before. The pressure that I, as a U.S. government employee, put on Japan for decades to lower trade barriers and to be more open in its economy with the rest of the world, it worked. And now for us to be putting up trade barriers makes us, A, look ridiculous to the rest of the world, B, is a stab in the back to all of those countries who believed us when we said, lower your trade barriers and we're going to create a better world for the future, and C, tears down the relationships that have made the world safer and more secure. And I'm terrified. I mean, I'm literally terrified of what could come if this continues. First of all, if we aren't going to lead and offer to protect small countries that need our security assistance, they're going to turn to someone else. And that someone else increasingly could be China, maybe Russia. I don't think so. It's going to be China. And secondly, we're going to be left behind in the economic sphere. They're just going to start trading amongst themselves, look for new markets for their products, look for new places to buy their products, and we're going to be here all by ourselves.
Hadrian, I wonder what your perspective is on that from Canada.
Well, I mean, I think Cecile hit all the right points there. The one thing I would add is how difficult it will be for the U.S. to undo the damage, even with the new administration, because it's so, how can we trust a country that after signing a trade deal, as we recall, Trump signed the latest version of the USMCA just a few years ago, and then is now ignoring it to serve, you know, his own, whatever, short-term political aspirations. I'm not totally clear on the motive, but how could Canada now sign a new agreement or negotiate knowing that the U.S. is not negotiating in good faith? And that lack of trust really undermines the U.S.'s ability to negotiate with the rest of the world and to offer any sort of guarantee, expect any sort of guarantee from other countries. Now, I think one of the big open questions is, you know, how long does that last? If there's a new president, does that change? You know, there's a lot of hardliners in Canada right now saying we'll never negotiate with the U.S. again. I think that's probably too strong. But this trust issue is really foundational. If you don't honor your agreements, other people aren't going to sign agreements with you.
Cecile, can you maybe that actually leads to this idea of, like, if tomorrow Trump takes the podium in the White House and walks back all the tariffs, right? 10%, the blanket tariff, the tariffs on Canada, Mexico, the reciprocal tariffs, so-called. Would that change how countries are looking at the U.S.?
So I think there's three answers to that. One is it would help for sure. At least maybe we would stop the world's stock indices from tanking, which would be a step in the right direction. Secondly, our reputation was about trade, but it was about a lot more. It was about a country that, you know, it took us a while to get to the right place sometimes, but we eventually did the right thing. We eventually stuck up for countries that were, you know, supporting human rights. We eventually took in the world's neediest people. We eventually set an example for the rest of the world of what a thriving democracy could look like. And we don't look like that anymore. We just don't. And so we've lost kind of this vision of a value-laden society, which, you know, wasn't always true, right? We had a lot of faults, but we were moving in the right direction. And so we've lost that kind of moral leadership, in addition to losing this free trade leadership that we were the leaders of since 1945, 1950, we're not there. And now, you know, the most damaging thing, I think, in the long term is that we are turning our back on our defense allies. First among those is Canada. Our militaries have always worked side by side, almost as one military, certainly in the north, in the part of the country where we are located right now. Our air forces operate as one air force. And the fact that we now have a president who is insulting Canada and calling them freeloaders and threatening to kind of force them to become a state, it's embarrassing. It's also dangerous because we may be militarily extremely strong, but we still need allies. And for us to have allies, those allies have to know beyond a shadow of a doubt that we will be there for them in the same way that they have always been here for us. You know, the Japanese have been here for us. The Europeans were here for us after 9/11. The Canadians for sure are always here for us. I mean, in the early days of the Trump administration, while he was insulting Canada, Canadian firefighters and helicopter and aircraft pilots were fighting the fires in Los Angeles for us. And so if we're going to expect people to be there for us, we have to be there for them. And the rhetoric out of this administration is clearly that we will not be there for them.
Hadrian, we're running up on the end of the hour here, but I was reminding myself this morning, to Cecile's point, 40,000 Canadians served in Afghanistan, both military and civilian. 158 armed forces members died, other aid workers, a diplomat. The only reason Canadians were in Afghanistan in that capacity is because the United States asked them to be. I wonder, you know, emotionally, personally, or if you just want to take it more broadly, you know, what it's been like in the last few months.
Yeah, it's, I mean, thanks for that. And I mean, Cecile, again, laid it out really well. I mean, one of the biggest feelings I think we're having in Canada right now is a sense of betrayal. Now, what more could we have done as an ally, you know, economically in matters of defense, socially and culturally? I mean, we're some of the most integrated economies in the world. We've always been there for the U.S. The U.S. has always been there for us, too. So it really throws into question a lot of the kind of foundations of this relationship, how we think about the future of this country. It's challenging, and it's hard to know where to land. I mean, I said it before, I'll say it again, there's just so much uncertainty. I think, to be clear, I mean, Canadians don't want to end this relationship with the U.S. on any measure. And it feels like an unprovoked attack on the U.S.'s closest ally, unjustified, damaging. And the people who are going to be hurt the most are working people, right? On both sides of the border. People are going to lose jobs. They're going to have to absorb higher costs. And it is regular households, you know, regular families that are going to pay the price for all of this, putting aside all of these longer term strategic and economic considerations. So it all just feels so needless, I think.
Barbara, just a minute or two left. I wonder if you can leave us on a note of optimism. We did get a message from Amy in Wakanda, who asked, I thought Congress was in charge of taxes. Since when does the executive branch just get to slap taxes on stuff? So can you, is there any world you can envision in which Congress could reassert some authority here and change the direction our government is heading?
Absolutely. I think Congress could. I mean, Congress does have that role. The only time the president can do it is when he declares that there's a war. And he declared there was a war on because of the border situation with Mexico, which is a whole nother issue. But I think that's actually what needs to happen. And I think some of the people who have been following along with Trump in Congress are starting to realize that there's a lot more at stake here. We can't destroy the infrastructure as well as destroying external relationships and have nothing to build it back up. And that's my concern with this from an agricultural standpoint or a business standpoint, is there we're just cratering out internally and externally at the same time. And what will we be left with? It will be a new order. We will never be able to go back to where we were. The booming economy of a year ago is gone. Relationships are changed. We will build back somehow, but it won't ever go back the same.
Well, I don't know that that's an optimistic note, but we'll have to leave it there. Barbara Ribbon, Cecile Shea, and Hadrian Mertens-Kirkwood, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and perspective with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, build back somehow. Okay. Barbara Ribbons is director of the Carson and Iris Varner International Business Institute at Illinois State University. Cecile Shea is a non-resident senior fellow on global security and diplomacy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Hadrian Mertens-Kirkwood is a senior researcher at the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. That's all the time we have on the program today. Coming up tomorrow, we'll be talking with an editor at the New York Times who has a new book called Murder the Truth, which looks at a long-running campaign to end the special libel protections that news media enjoys. We'll also talk about the broader issue of newspaper consolidation in the United States and what that means for our information environment and our democracy. That's all coming up tomorrow here on The 21st Show, which is produced by Christine Hatfield, Harrison Melkin, and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Colson Kahn. Technical direction and engineering from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening.